Amigos de Music in Two Flavors, Music in Dos Sabores, this is your host, Jaime Riera. As you realize, today's episode is going to be in English. It was about time that at last I came with the English episode. And today's guest is one of the most, for me, it's one of the most important people that I consider right now in the music industry regarding my whole podcast in English. And doesn't mean that the other guests in English are not worthy. Is because the role she has played in the music world, bringing out names and making people realize that there were much more important tasks performed by women in music that history, academicians, and many other factors try to hide from our books, of our readings, even from media. But we're going to talk about that just in a moment. Just let me just make some clearinghouse notes here first. So I apologize first for uploading the episode today. It was supposed to be uploaded yesterday, but things happen at the office and weekends is taking a different turn that it's making me more like a slacker, becoming tiresome and trying to figure out how to manage my time. So I'm trying to figure out things, how to, you know, re-energize myself and try to find energy to work on my things that I really love. But work and my passion for music, they're colliding. It's like two planets colliding and creating a supernova, but in this case, work is taking too much of a toll. So I'm figuring out how to work on that part. Secondly, let me thank all of you for tuning in and listening to this episode. Without you, there is no purpose for this podcast to be on or cyberspace. So thank you so much for listening to it, for downloading it, And if you like this episode, this first part of the episode, because it's going to be two parts. The episode lasted 2 hours, recording 2 hours. So I split it in two parts. That is why you have 195.1. So 195.2 is going to be uploaded next Wednesday. That doesn't mean that the podcast is going to be coming back to the weekly basis uploading. It's going to remain on a bi-weekly. But since this episode is so long, I don't want you to wait a week to listen to the second part. I just want you to listen to it the next week. So it's going to be like that when I have episodes that long. Thirdly, if you like to donate money to my podcast and you like the work I do, there is two ways to donate money. Through Ko-fi, Ko-fi. You can find the description, the link on the description of this episode. So there is my name. There is ko-fi.com/musicintoflavors. You can find it. And then you can invite me to a virtual coffee if you want to. If you listen to the podcast through iVoox, the blue icon, I think it's blue. I believe it's blue. Blue button of being a patron for iVoox, a sponsor of my podcast, is activated. So you can click there. And the minimum amount for donations there is $2. I mean, $2 costs a cup of coffee, even a soda, probably if you go to 7-Eleven and take a special sale. But anyhow, there is two ways. If you cannot donate any kind of money, then the best way to help me spread the word is by sharing this episode and my podcast through your favorite social media. That could be Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, whatever you listen to my podcast. I mean, whatever social media you use, you can share in those platforms. And the more people listen to my podcast, the better, because they will get to know more about the people I interview, the people I talk to. And believe me, what I bring to you is different what you used to listen through the mainstream media. It's very different. And particularly on this case, on episode Master 195.1, my guest is Joanna Ross Hersey. And she is many things, besides being the president of women in brass instruments association organization, being a master class teacher, being a great performer of brass instruments and euphonium. She also plays the trombone, being a professor at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, and now being the Dean Associate of the Music Department, former U.S. Coast Guard band brass instrument. And there's so much things about Joanna that will take probably, miles and miles of information to provide to you about her. But whatever you want, I mean, if you want to know more about her, it's going to be on this episode. And the link for her website is going to be on the description of this episode. And one of the good things that I like, I mean, I met Joanna through Twitter. That's a great way to meet great people. And I reached out to her and asked her about her CDs, her music. I wanted to listen to her music, specifically one CD that has female composers, because I'm into that. It's not a trend thing, it's a thing that I found very interesting. And I believe that women play an important role in music, but men decided to, in a way, hid the information from us. So I'm in this journey to find more about these great composers, these great performers, and bring it out to the light. And Joanna, as well as Emma Rush, the guitar performer who I interviewed a few episodes back, Joanna is one of those people that is working on making, in a way, making a change to our music history. For example, in her thesis that she wrote on 2009, the thesis is, her dissertation, sorry, is 2006, is Such on Feminine Instruments, Women Brass Musicians Before 1940. It's like 92 pages long, or 100 pages long, I don't remember. I just finished the thesis, and I will tell you that it's one of the most incredible pieces of research and investigation that anyone who loves history can have a grip on it and start reading from beginning to the end. There is so much information, so much detail, so much data there that you realize that the world, the way the world was shaped to be addressed in a manly way. And one of the examples that she uses in her thesis is in chapter one. I have other parts that I'm going to read to you in the next episode. But one of the things is that the way that she reached out, the way she expresses these concerns are completely, I mean, left me completely baffled the way the Victorian way was embedded in many people's brains. For example, she, on her chapter one, she mentioned this person who made a critic of this performer, and he said that seeing her abilities, he would allow his children to take classes from her. And one of the things that she questioned him is, you know, why are you questioning or making the assumption that based on her abilities, you will allow your children to take classes from her? On that review, he mentioned other performers, and he never mentioned the abilities of the male performers. And that's one of the examples that she uses through her thesis in explaining how men shaped everyone's brain, how it was everything redacted or drafted in her brain. There's another example that she uses of this female that writes about music in a review, and she addresses everything on the male gender instead of using a non-gender way to address everything. So the link for the this dissertation is going to be in the description as well. So if you want to read it and go through them, you're going to find it very, very interesting. And besides, very informative of how things were viewed and how things were shaped against all notion that women not only were capable of playing great music, but were also capable of writing, composing great music and being great performers. On this episode, we discuss an example of one person who was who won the appointment to be the first violin in a German philharmonic. But I'm not going to give you any spoilers, because I don't remember if it was in this first part or it was in the second part. I believe it's going to be on the second part, but I'm not going to give any spoilers. Let's just jump in immediately, as we did on this recording, with my conversation with Joanna Rose Hersey. And I hope that you like it. So without further ado, let's listen to Joanna. I haven't finished your dissertation. There is there is 54 pages left.
But I think you got the gist, right? You got all the historical stuff. That was the main point.
My question is, how many people that have been interviewed you has read your...
I think you're probably the only one.
Well, besides the other person who just asked about your dissertation that just... Right. And she's from Germany, and she's a tuba player.
Yes, and so she knows me because when I go each year, of course, COVID stopped it, but we have a relationship because she went to a low brass or a brass workshop that I teach at in Germany. And she came, and we befriended each other. And yes, and she used to live in the U.S., so she's super wonderful and got great English. And so
that's one of the things that I always struggle with many people that works in academia, is that their thesis remains within that field, never goes out.
Yep, that was a really good point you made when you posted it. Like, let's talk about these. And I did publish a little of it. That would have been just in the same a little journal that 12 people read.
And the thing is that this dissertation is more relevant today than a year ago, because all the things happening now.
Oh my gosh. Yes. It's not automatic that you gain rights over time.
Yeah, so, I mean, there is a specific topic of the guidelines I sent you that when I went through, I was like, I'm the dumbest person ever. How I can just narrow the fame of women performers in just one person where there's so many people mentioned right here.
Right.
I was like, I just fall into the trap of internet that when you start looking and searching for specific people, like, for example, the search that I did was famous tuba player. I was only one person mentioned. But on your dissertation, you have more people that are relevant that made a big step towards women's rights and much more. And we're missing that in the news, on mainstream media. But, I mean, I'm having a blast reading your dissertation. My wife always says that when I get, she says, you're going to read a thesis? And I say, yes.
Hopefully it's not so bad.
It is not bad. The thing is that she said, she has a PhD in neuropsychology. And she says always thesis remains within academia field. You defend your thesis and that's it.
Right.
The only person that will have a look at it is another person writing about that topic or researching on a topic, you know, that has some connection to it. And that's it.
Right. It's true. We spend all that time, more than a year, closer to 2 years. Yeah.
That's why I said that we need to publish at least one chapter of your thesis out there so people can get to know more about a huge difference women has made in music field that is not getting noticed. And it cannot be remained within the female right activists. It should be spread across, you know, across every genre. It should not be like you said in one of the parts right here on the magazine that you also author. It should not be gender-based. It should be non-gender. There should be no gender related to reading these topics. And I was making a connection with your thesis with Laura Tunbridge, Beethoven's the book is about Beethoven. Life in Ninth Symphony. I think that's the title. And she mentioned a lot of women of the high class that perform Beethoven's symphonies and pieces. And it connects with yours saying that women well trained in music in the upper class just to keep playing within that small circle to entertain their guests.
Yeah.
And their family, nothing. And that's it. But then there's a topic that you mentioned your thesis, and we're already recording.
That's okay.
So there's one thing that in your thesis that you mentioned that many women were considered like lower class when they performed percussion, like a tambourine, and they were like in a way connected to low life class, like some kind of work not acceptable within social standards of the time.
That's right.
Like the gypsies. And I was remembering in the Spanish culture in Spain when the women played the tambourine, they were thought that she was working on a burlesque place or prostitute place because she was playing tambourine in a sexy way. But they were gypsies.
That's right.
And gypsies, that's where it comes to flamenco. And I was making all this connection about how the authors you mentioned there, like I think it's Goldie, the name of the person who wrote the etiquette book about how to be a woman. I think it was Goldie. It was Goldie. Oh, wait. Let me just look for my reference right here. He was in the 1860s after the Civil War that he wrote about women.
Right. Behaviors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Goldies. It was Goldies. It wasn't that bad. Gosh.
Good job.
Yeah. So it is funny, but let me welcome you to Music Into Flavors, Music Into Sabores, because it is proper to welcome you and to thank you for all you have done, especially on this dissertation that I think I mean, I'm still enjoying it. It's like finding a new source of information and breaking the paradigms and stereotypes that we have been fed for a longer time.
That's right.
And here, the top, I mean, I love the way you address everything. But let's go, before going in depth into this part of the thesis, we already been talking about it. Let's talk about your, you know, upbringing in Vermont. How was your family? I mean, what kind of music your family listened to? Was your family very musical? Do you have parents who were into the music field?
Well, it's interesting because my family has some musical elements to it, but like many children, I grew up after a strong event of divorce when I was very young. My mother married and had two small children. My mother wasn't especially musical. She was a basketball player and had lots of other talents, a horsewoman. She still loves horses today. Musical talent is not something that she pursued. But my grandfather played the trumpet in the home growing up and was a jazz musician. So she grew up in a musical home, but my mom didn't pursue that. And then she divorced and took her two young children up to Vermont because she had vacationed there and she knew it would be a good place to raise children where the cost was lower and she knew the schools would be good. So we were very poor and growing up was a struggle for her to raise us on her own. And she did work my whole childhood and gave us what she could, but it wasn't a household where we had a lot of money to spend on extracurricular activities. So my sister and I both worked during high school as soon as we could. And both of us took music from school. And so my sister played the flute and was musical. And I, of course, took the tuba, but it was because of the school program. And so she listened to the music of the sort of the pop music of the time.
It was disco. Like you have disco. ABBA. You have, yeah. Of course. Yes. It was 1970s.
She loved Kenny Rogers, right? And right. So the these kind of folk and early rock musicians, that was who she loved to listen to. And country music. She loves Dolly Parton. And so those are great musical influences. And Kenny Rogers, that was the first album I had, the Gambler album on a CD, which was new. So that's an interesting influence. And then when I was in grade school, Michael Jackson, I had that on vinyl, because the Thriller album.
It was 1982 when Michael Jackson came back with Beat It. It was Thriller, the LP.
Oh my gosh, what a great album. And so that was one of the first ones that I had coming up in middle school, grade school. And so a lot of that wonderful music was in our home, but we didn't, of course, have cable TV. We got two channels and then you went outside. If you didn't like what you were watching on TV, you just went and played outside. And it was a lower income upbringing without a lot of extras, no summer camps, no fancy travel, just a really great, strong home. But my mom knew if we wanted to do music, that was okay. Sometimes we find in the arts that rural, lower economic areas don't always push their kids into the arts because they're afraid that that won't give them a good living. And we see a lot of emphasis on STEM for the science. And so
I'm being an attorney, businessman, yes, accounting, medicine, right. Like all the, you know, typical fields that if you be a musician, you're going to be hungry. You will not make a living. Yes. You will have bills to pay. You're going to raise a family.
Right. So totally understandable, of course. And in my mom, you know, my mom really did understand. She was a bit of a hippie and she understood that you need to follow your calling. So when I said to her, I'm going to go and I'm going to major in tuba.
But just, I mean, the difference in your case is that you did like a two concentrations was in gender. And I think it was in Harvard University that you did music and gender equality studies, right?
Yes, and the gender came later. So,
well, it was in Arizona. It was in Arizona.
Yes, I started in Arizona for tuba. So that was only tuba. The gender was not there yet. I didn't know that that was something you could do. And it probably was only just beginning at that point. In 1989 was when I started college and my undergraduate degree. And that was tuba, tuba, tuba. And it was after I won my audition for the Coast Guard Band and I moved to Connecticut And I looked around and I thought, all right, I need to finish this degree. I had only done 2 years, and then I left school because I had won that audition. So it's a great opportunity. I gave up my scholarship. I moved to Connecticut and I became an active duty military musician. And that's great. I did not have my degree. So I wanted to finish, but I worked full time. And because this is the era before online classes, it's now pretty easy now to finish your degree when you work full time. But in 1992, it wasn't.
But it's not the same. I mean, for me, it's not the same studying online that being, you know, presential or doing or in person taking classes, because it just means the social content of interaction with people. And one of the things I remember, one of the things that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor mentioned in the latest case that she cited on diversity is that the purpose of diversity in colleges is just to make, I mean, that was the defense of University of Texas. It was not Sandra Day O'Connor. It was the latest case. It was in 2016. University of Texas said that the purpose of diversity and having people and selecting people from different cultures, it makes the college, it makes the university or educational campus more diverse and develops these connections and these ties that makes the learning process more more productive.
Right.
And
that's right.
And online, sometimes you miss that part. I know that we're moving towards it, even working from distance and teleworking.
Yeah.
But we're missing the social connection with people and the empathy, because that's one of the things that we have lost through the COVID. We have empathy.
Absolutely. We need to practice that. And our students and our young people haven't had that opportunity to practice that and get good at it. Right. Absolutely. And so that is something that, looking forward as educators and as adults and parents and people, we're going to need to replace that now in all of us, but especially in our younger students that didn't get, they lost 2 years of practicing caring for each other. Yeah.
Unless you go into the military service and get disciplined there, which is good. Certainly. When you were active in the U.S. Coast Guard, I thought that the U.S. Coast Guard has the base located in Rhode Island. Do they have
one? It's right next to Rhode Island. It's on the Connecticut side. That's all very close together there. Yeah. So it's New London, Connecticut, just a hop over the border into Rhode Island. Yeah, not far. The river is there as the border. And that's the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, which is a very beautiful place. That is where all the officers train. And that is where the band is stationed. And it's a beautiful place.
It is funny because one of the things, I have a friend who was a Jack within the U.S. Army. And he used to be a Coast Guard volunteer. He told me that one of the things that, for example, in Puerto Rico, when they tried to recruit you, they would never mention you about their campus in Rhode Island. Like Annapolis, the U.S. Navy mentioned Annapolis, you have U.S. Army, West Point, the U.S. Air Force has another one. I think it's in Colorado. But U.S. Coast Guard will never mention that they have a school in Rhode Island, that they prefer recruiting the people to work immediately as a petty officer and not going to school. And I was like, gosh, if I knew about that, I would have enrolled in U.S. Coast Guard school because of the advantages and the learning that you have with them and the opportunity of exchange information, education, and develop new, you know, networking. How would that help you in your education formation with the U.S. Coast Guard during those years? I know that you were 19 years old when you were playing tuba.
Right. And you don't enroll there. It's only where you go to work, but you are next to those cadets, those students. And I was there for 7 years. So going in and out every morning and working with the students. Sometimes there is a band of the cadets, the student band, which sometimes you work with. And so while I didn't get to take the classes with them, I was there, and it's such a great learning environment. And the professors, who are male and female, teaching math and engineering, they do arts, they do theater. They're really getting a really well-rounded education with a lot of internship and hands-on, going out on the boats and learning how to sail. And I really try to be more open now with gender and race to make sure that it's more diverse than it would have looked like 50 years ago.
And now more that we have a female admiral.
So great.
Yeah,
Yes.
it was about 2 weeks ago that she was appointed the command. I think it's the com is the commandant the title that she holding.
The commandant is the title of the commandant of the Coast Guard, we would say, the head commandant. And I also saw the captain taking over recently for the Coast Guard Eagle, I believe, which is who is female. So it's wonderful to see the women that have stuck in there to rise through the ranks that are getting to these posts.
It was about time.
I mean, yes, it was.
I mean, it's the thing is that I always say that in order to achieve equality, it's not by enacting new statutes or the legislation. It's just acting on it. I mean, changing words and changing and enacting statutes doesn't make the cut if you don't enforce it or act in an active way in order to make acknowledgement that females and male are all equal. And her appointments made a great point on into that after President Biden appointed her. And he was right. It was about time that we have a female Admiral Commandant on one of the U.S. Armed Forces. I hope we can see more on that soon on the Navy, the Marines, because I have seen ladies that are more tougher than men.
And you know, if you've gotten that far, you know that anybody, male or female, but you need the right combination of authority so that people trust and kindness so that they know you. And that's a hard thing for a man or a woman, but it's especially hard for a woman. There's an assumed, you know, competence that men, this sort of come with an assumption of competence, but women, you have to earn it first.
Yeah, and the other thing about the stereotypes is that, as you mentioned in your thesis, is that females are considered more emotional than men. And I have seen women in high-ranking positions within private enterprises that when they talk about business, this is business, and there is no emotion in business.
Right.
And they're very serious, and they will do whatever they have to do to make everything accountable and accomplished. So when people go through your thesis and see how the Victorian era view women and start to act, you know, to bring those ideas nowadays, you will realize that, you know, we were so dumb. Men were so dumb. And I think they were afraid of acknowledging that there were people with the same quality and capacity to do things that much better than most of the men. But leaving that to the side, because we have talked too much about that topic, that is still a current topic and issue that hasn't been solved. Once you finish with the United States Coast Guard, I mean, let's go to the U.S. Coast Guard. How was that experience in the band? How much you get from playing into the band, and how much that helped you to improve your music skills?
The military bands are such high-level organizations, and within the military bands, there's levels. And the bands at the top, we sometimes use the term premier or the premier bands to designate that that's the top one in each of the services, such as the President's Own United States Marine Band. There's other Marine bands that are amazing. And then there's the top one, the premier band. The Coast Guard has one professional band only, so it gets that designation as the premier. And it's very competitive. You have these beautiful programs to pay off your student loans. You get a nice salary and prestige and travel. And so there's a lot of people that come to those auditions. And for you to go up and play for your 5 or 10 minutes against what could be 60 or 70 players, depending on the day and your instrument, it's highly competitive and they're very picky. So once you get there, you sit yourself down in the section with these amazing players who understand what they have. They're grateful for the fact that they get to sit down and play every day and represent something that has a history. So I found, being young, I won the audition at 19, and there was a little bit of a delay due to the Desert Storm, and sometimes they do hiring freezes. So even though I might have been 21 when I enlisted and they were so helpful in a way that was very respectful. My friend Vic, who sat next to me, he sat on my right for bass trombone. He would never talk down to me, of course, because he was my professional colleague. But he might lean over and he might say, can we tune this? Or, or I'm going to breathe here, he would say. So it just in a kind way, if there were things that I needed coaching with, and I did a lot of tuba euphonium quartet and brass quintet. And those two things have served me well over the course of my career, being able to do that. They also let you do a lot of solo work, which you wouldn't automatically think of because you're imagining band playing, which is what it was all day. But they had Sunday afternoon chamber and solo recitals for the community that were free. Mm-hmm. And you could program solo works. And I played all sorts of things to get my solo list checked off because I, of course, hadn't had all of the... Most of the musicians have master's degrees and some even come in with doctoral degrees already. So it's a very highly educated group. And I felt a little behind because I hadn't finished yet. So it was really wonderful.
So it's harder to get there, I mean, to get a position there compared to symphony orchestras, or is the same
level?
I
would say it's similar. Yeah, the salary is set. You talked about the officers and the enlisted being two levels. The enlisted has 9 ranks, and they bring you in already 6 up from the bottom. They bring you in at an E6 rank so that the salary will be competitive to that of a medium-sized symphony orchestra. And the salaries can be quite competitive if you rise up to the senior petty officer ranks. Those salaries, again, would be more comparable to the top symphony orchestras. And so they try to make it desirable for these higher level musicians that might have been able to win a position so that you really have the best of the best.
Do you have the chance of touring with them across the US and outside?
Yes, I did a lot of touring during my time. We would have a standard 2-week tour in the summer and then sometimes a spring tour, and it varied a little bit depending on the budgets and the particular year, but we would often do a large summer tour around Grand Haven, Michigan, which has a Coast Guard parade that is Coast Guard City, USA, and they have a Coast Guard parade. And we would always make sure that we started or ended the tour there to march in that parade.
Nice.
And then sometimes we would go down to the south or up. I remember one of my favorite tours was we did the California coastline, and I think we might have flown into Seattle and then toured all the way down, and that was very lovely. So they quadrant the U.S. and they make a tour in each area and then they rotate through. And so you can go on the website and see where they are at any given time.
Oh, nice. Do they give you the instruments or you have to bring your own instrument?
They give you the instruments, again, depending on the budget year. Often they are able to say to you, tell us what you'd like, and then they will buy it. If it's a tighter, it was a leaner budget time when I was in the early 90s. So I did play my own horn, and they said, we have 3 or 4 tubas. You may use them as you please. And to me, I thought, no, I'd like to keep mine. So I did play mine. But that is a choice. And I think a lot of times, especially with less expensive instruments than the tuba, you are able to get the kind that you want because you do wear and tear your instrument a good amount. So it's nice if it's not your very own.
And the reeds are not that cheap. I mean, the reeds are very expensive.
Right.
And you have
and
to change them. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So the equipment, things like valve oil, that it's all provided. Right.
So how much is a tuba? It would be over $1,000, I'm assuming, right?
Yes, you can get one that I wouldn't want you to play for maybe $1,000. And then you can get one that I would want you to play.
That's the Kmart tuba.
I call them tin cans. So you would need, if I'm advising a student, I tell them that I want them to buy something used and I want them to have about $6,000 ready. And then they can get a very good professional level used tuba in that $6,000 to $7,000 range. And then there are tubas that go upwards of $30,000.
Yeah, I have seen that.
Yeah. There's no reason to buy one new, though, because there's such a good market in used, and a well-made tuba, like anything, will last if it's been well taken care of. My tuba that I play on and have recorded on, and I'm about to take it to Washington, D.C. tomorrow to play a series.
Are you coming tomorrow?
I'm coming tomorrow. That tuba was manufactured in 1989, and it's my tuba that I bought to go off to college.
That's
with
the Yamaha one?
The Rudolf Meinl, the German horn.
Oh, okay.
My Yamaha was, I think, 1984. So yes, those are both older horns.
How many tubas you have?
I have two tubas. I had to stop and think. That's terrible. No, I think I only have two. And I right now I own two euphoniums and a trombone. And so, yeah, so most of us have to stop and think. Hold on. How many? Yes. And I know I'm about to buy a second trombone in the fall because it's a special instrument. So then I'll have two trombones after that.
Yeah, I mean, you never can have that many tubas. There is that many tubas. It's like never too many guitars.
Exactly. And we, of course, we have different tubas for different activities. And so in orchestra, yesterday I played a small orchestra with choir concert. And so I used my larger horn, even though it was in a church, but I just played quietly. And it had that nice resonance because it was a small orchestra and I knew there were no string basses. So I wanted the nice wide resonance and I just played quietly and they mic'd the choir. So we were good.
Do you need a mic? Do you need a special mic for the tuba or you can?
Well, you just need one that would pick up low resonance, which not every mic does, as long as it's going to pick up. I don't normally feel like I need to be mic'd in any average performance situation necessarily, because I'm going to come through pretty well. So these gigs that I'm doing this coming week, it's a brass quintet in the lobby of a large space and we won't need any microphones.
Okay. When you went to have your master degree and PhD degree, I mean, how different in tuba learning process are from each other? I mean, what's the difference between a master? I know that, I mean, there's differences in the classes and everything and techniques and performances, but what makes the PhD more interesting to pursue over keeping a master degree?
That's a really good question. And I'm going to start with the undergraduate degree. So the undergraduate degree's goal is to rein you in from any crazy stuff you might have picked up along the way and get you playing in a square box and get you situated properly from low to high. You can play in tune. You learn the standard repertoire and you don't do anything crazy. And you do a bunch of scales and routine and you don't do anything outlandish and you just do square, solid stuff over and over until you're really solid. And that's the undergraduate. And then when I got to my, and that, not that that's not wonderful, you still, it's still very growth oriented, but it's within a somewhat narrow focus. Like no one would have ever wanted me to touch a trombone. That will mess with your time. You need to focus on tuba and you need to do it 6 hours a day. And that is all you need to be doing. And don't mess with gender stuff or history, like just practice the tuba. So then when I got to my master's degree, this was when in my coursework, we were starting to talk about investigating things that you're passionate about, because now I've already learned the boxes from my undergraduate degree and I can look at, I took a class on the music of the French Revolution and I took a class just on the music of Charles Ives, an entire semester, 3-credit class, just on the music of one composer who's, not that I don't love Charles Ives, but he's not considered a major composer. Mm-hmm. So that was an example where you spent an entire time talking. We listened to every piece he wrote, and the instructor just stood at the board. He played the music, and he would write as the music was flowing. We listened to all the works, and he just wrote on the board. He drew maps, like here this oboe, and then he would draw squiggles, and we would see the map of the piece unfold on the board, and then he would just talk over the recording. Listen to this, and he would speak to us, and we listened to all of the works. And it was one of the most amazing classes I've ever taken. On the tuba side of the masters, the same thing was happening. Instead of being forced into this box over and over again, now I would have an entire lesson on the 6 opening bars of the solo in Mahler 1. So for an hour, it wouldn't be soft enough.
Wow. You know that they're becoming a trend, the master classes. And the master classes is a thing from 10, 20 years ago. But there were not such a thing, you know, or not promoted like it is currently now.
Yeah.
Do you have the opportunity to take master classes when you were doing your master and PhD?
Yes, we did. We had
classes are very different compared to PhD. It's like more concentrated, like more condensed, addressed to specific technical parts of playing, right?
Right. And you have such limited time. And so where I see the master classes were not as common back when I was in school. I can remember maybe going to two, whereas my students at Pembroke go to two every semester. Like I only remember ever there being two. People didn't travel in that same way. But I think one of the main goals of master classes is you have to get up there and play for this total stranger. And it's like audition training. You don't know what they're going to say. You're in front of all your peers. It could even be filming. Like you might be live on Facebook. You have to get up there and make it happen when you've been sitting in the room while the other people did it. So you're not warmed up. And I think it's like a on the hot seat kind mm-hmm. of thing. Yeah. The idea is, can you produce and can then you change it? Because in an audition, they might say, can I have that again? But go ahead and be a little more staccato. Right. And so that you're in front of the masterclass with Demondre Thurman and Demondre Thurman says, Joanna, that's just lovely. But can I have that again and try more staccato? And then you just need to do it in front of everybody on the Facebook Live or whatever the scenario. So I think that to me is the value for the students in the masterclasses. Will they really remember what Demondre Thurman said? Who knows? They're petrified with fear. I don't know. Somebody like me always tries to take notes when my students are up there so that because I know they won't actually remember anything.
How many female were playing tuba or taking classes of tuba or brass during your years in master and PhD?
Well, I was the only one for tuba, all of them. And there were some others in some of the other instruments. Like there was a trumpet player, Ginger Turner, who went into the Army Band. And she and I are still on the board together of the International Women's Brass Conference. And she was a doctoral student at Arizona State when I got there. So she and I have known each other since 1989. And we're still working together. We have a relationship that goes all through across the years. I think it really does bond you. So I could look around and see some of the other instruments, but I never played in a section with other women on tuba and euphonium until I got into things like the Athena Brass Band.
I see. What's the difference between euphonium and the tuba? Because I've seen that there's a difference, but sometimes they're used like, you know, without any distinction.
Right. Sometimes people are more familiar with the phrase tenor tuba.
Okay.
It's in the register of the trombone. That's the big difference. It's an octave higher.
I see.
So you can play the same notes if you go way down in the low, but the euphonium or tenor tuba has the same register as the trombone. And so it can sit out and zing out a little bit more. And when you put them together in a band with the basses and the trombones, it's conical so that the shape of the tube is wider in places and it's warmer and darker than a trombone. So it's sometimes called the cello of the wind ensemble, right? And so then we have this trombone with the euphonium and the tuba in a wind band that will really bring depth to that mid register. And the same is true of British brass band.
I see. I was trying to figure out the differences because in the dictionary, they don't mention the difference between, I mean, regarding the term like contrabass, bass, tenor or contralto or things like that. I was like, okay, you know, they're being used in a distinct way, so maybe they have different range in sounds. During your years at the master and PhD, who were the most influential professors on your educational path?
They were my private teachers because this was by chance, that both of the men that I studied with, my master's teacher was Chester Schmitz. He's a wonderful musician. He played principal tuba with the Boston Symphony for his whole career. And he had lessons with me every week for the time that I was there. I would, in fact, sometimes go have the lessons in the basement of Boston Symphony Hall and go in.
Wow.
The doorman would let me in and I would go down into the basement and he would have a concert later. So he would get some lessons in before. And he treated me no differently and pushed me. And like I mentioned that an entire lesson about being softer, the master's lessons were about pushing yourself out of the box that you showed you could be in. You learned all your basics. And so he would really encourage me to try. He let me play music by women on one of my master's recitals. I think that was probably the first time that had ever happened at New England Conservatory. I played all these pieces by women. He was fine with that. He coached me on them. And then he sat next to my mom in the front row when I played them. And he was so supportive and wonderful. And so he was a huge mentor for me. Then I went on to do my doctorate at the Hart School of Music. And Steve Perry, who was principal tuba in the Hartford Symphony for his career and a fine educator. He was the same way. He got me going and he was honest and forthright and he didn't just assume that I would go on and get married and have kids. And he knew maybe I might need to make my living with this thing. And so he was, and I feel like that's a definition of respect, that you're going to tell somebody if it's not right, because they're going to need to fix it. And he was wonderful. And he took me through 3 recitals for my doctorate, and was just such a mentor. So those two men.
It's not like the case of Smedvig, right?
It's not. You know, I want to tell you a story about that.
I'm going to look for that video. I want to see that video in the master class.
I have my grandmother clipped. She took the Boston Globe. My grandmother lived outside of Boston, and she clipped out an article. There was an article in the Boston Globe about how he had been sexist to some students, and some of the discussion of this in the 90s, this would have been, I guess. And she clipped it out and mailed it to me. I'm like, yeah, I know, Grandma.
Yeah, I mean, it's like everything. I always discuss this with guitar performers about Segovia's attitude toward female performers during his last performance before him for graduation purposes in California. And he will, he will dismiss women performers, not in the good sense. I mean, he was very dismissive. He would never consider... Yeah. Women performers to his level, standard level of playing, compared to male, like Frisk, like Tennant, and many other, and John Williams as well. Well, John Williams said that he was an egocentric person. His ego was too high, and he was very obnoxious. And that's what said by a former student of Segovia. But when I was reading down your dissertations about Smedvig, I was just remembering Segovia's video clips and the way he addressed female. And one of the things that I have listened a lot is about female finishing their careers, but not continuing performing or following the path in music, because they get married, they get children, they start a family, and they don't have the time to pursue their passion of music. That's not your case. I mean, right. You are all around. I mean, you have a family, you have kids, you have a husband. How do you manage to raise kids, dedicate time to them, but at the same time, follow your passion and love for music and for tuba playing?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. And I've always felt like, because it's hard to do this when you're against a stereotype, right? So every day is hard because you're not what people expect, and you don't look like a tuba player or a trumpet player or whatever it is. And I've often thought that some of the smartest women who come up through school, because we do see a lot of young women studying at the collegiate level in the fine schools, they're really smart, and they could do lots of other things. And they look around at all the sexism they're experiencing, and they think, you know what? I'm going to do something else. And they don't stick with it. And I really, through the depth of my soul, love this tuba playing thing. And so it never got to the point where it was more hard to do it than to stop. And I think some people, they get to, and no bad on them, that they get to that point where it's too hard to do it and they want to do something else. And I can totally understand that, because I'm sure we all have our days, but I want to show that I can do it. I love doing it. I love my direction I'm taking it. I think no one else is in that direction, and I want to keep going, and I want to show it. And when I have those frustrating days, I try to use my circle of friends, and I try to go over it, because I always want to do it. And I think it's that desire to do it has to be so strong that you'll put up with, it's not that fun sometimes.
Well, it's not easy. I mean, life is not easy. And yeah. For a musician, making a living from music and from handling different tasks, like in your case, that you're also the president of a women brass society, and you have to do your research and publish papers, and you're also a dean in the Faculty of Music in North Carolina. I mean, you have too many things, and you have to divide your time on your personal life and your professional life. But I noticed that you have this balance. You achieved the balance between your passion and your family. And what I have read about your interviews is that the way you manage that, you don't, I mean, your family doesn't lose time with you. They have their time. But at the same time, you have your time for practice before starting classes. You right. have your own yeah. you know, routine. Like in the morning, you start warming up and practicing your scales on the tuba before getting into classes and doing the administrative work. So you, I mean, you can do it. If you can do it, any woman can do it as well.
Yeah,
I think that true. We are our own enemies because we are the ones that put obstacles in our, you know, in our passions or the path we want to take. I always say that if there is a problem, it's because we don't try to find the solution to the problem. There's always a solution to it.
One thing that I always tell the young women that I talk to, because I do a lot of mentoring, and one thing that I have done, which I don't regret, is I have skimped and saved financially so that I could hire babysitting help. And I've spent more money on babysitting. And so maybe I don't have so much in the bank, or right, I don't go on fancy vacations. And the money that I've spent over the time, and I have one son, he's 11 now, so it's easier. He can sit and play video games when I do my practice now. But all those years when he was so little and I needed the time to practice, or I needed to go to do concerts to keep myself in the game, I skimped around the budgets and took extra students and really watched my finances so that I could afford to have care for him so that I could get those minutes on the horn. And I notice with my young women that I mentor that might be newer moms, they feel guilty doing that. Because it's not required to have a babysitter just so that you can practice the tuba. It's required if you must go to work to do something else, but they don't see that time for themselves. And I really took that. I still do. I got up this morning before work today. It's Tuesday, Monday. I think it's Monday.
It's Monday.
And they're pretty good. I got up this morning. I'm in my routine and I got up. Checked on my son. He's fine. I played a 40-minute warm-up before I came to work. And then I'll come home tonight and try to get a little more time on the instrument because I have 3 or 4 concerts this week. And so I'm wanting to make sure. And so I've found, too, that scheduling the performances keeps me... It's part of that stereotyping. I want to go and sound good. So...
Do your son wants to pursue a career in music? He loves playing music, or he's into horns?
Interesting. It's interesting because I've watched so many of my colleagues, and maybe you agree, the musicians tend to want our children to also be musicians, and we tend to push that. And I've seen through the course of my life, watching the parents around me push that music very hard. And when my son was young, I gave him piano lessons myself at home. And that's not his thing.
How about the drums? The drums!
The drums would be more his thing. So that wasn't ideal. It's important. I think everyone should have some music training, of course, right? So I did what I thought was a good minimum, but it's, I don't think, an area that he would love. And I decided not to force him. And he does drawing and visual arts. So that is his art expression, sketching and drawing. And so that is where I'm putting him. And he's going to a theater camp this summer.
Nice.
Here at the university. So I'm working on the other arts, but I'm okay that he does it. He's played my tuba and trombone before just to make them sound. But I've decided not to push hard on the music because I've noticed, too, that it's often something that takes the parent away. So... Mama has to go do the tuba, and it's probably not something super positive in his mind because of that.
Do your husband get upset when you play a tuba?
Well, in earlier times, I was married, but I have been a single mom for the past 7 years.
Oh, so then scratch that. Yes. Scratch that.
So as in I think it's a good part of the story to tell because I think that when you see somebody out being successful on social media, maybe we don't see the behind the scenes. And behind the scenes, it's not always perfect. I do feel like it's good to showcase positivity in social media. So I don't show the behind the scenes when it's negative. But I do talk about it when we have conversations like this, because I think it's important to acknowledge that it is tough. And the things that I've made sure that I could do with babysitting money that have meant that I have turned down other opportunities because of putting that money towards babysitting instead, as we mentioned. And it is something to think about being away mm-hmm. on the holidays or a long tour. So there's a lot that goes into parenting and being a performing musician.
There are sacrifices the partner has to know. I mean, if you're serious in a relationship, you have to, I always believe in support. It's like when my wife decided to pursue her neuropsychology career, we were in a point that she said, well, in order to achieve, in order for me to become successful in my career, I need to go to the States. So I said, okay, so I quit my job.
Wow.
And we do what we have to do. So I quit my job so she can have an externship, because in Puerto Rico, the field neuropsychology, there is no most places to have an externship or practicum. So she can have hours of training and be considered for an internship and then for her fellowship. So I always said that, you know, marriage is like one unit composed of two people, and you have to support whatever you do, you have to support the other one in good or bad situation. So I said, okay, I quit my job. We go to the States. We have money. I mean, I can find a job and you can continue doing your externship. So I quit my job. We moved to Philadelphia. The externship was for free, so she worked for free.
Wow. Oh my goodness. So
I was unemployed for 6 months until I found a job, and I say, okay, I found a job in DC. So I would be commuting every day from Philly to DC and then to New York. And it was crazy. It was crazy times. Then we moved to New York for her internship. And it was that. I mean, you have to know where you get into it. In the case of the musicians, you know that musician, in order to be successful, it has to do touring, performances. You have to be aware that you have to sometimes be alone at home and take care of your kids. Because I would think that in the case of the women, because always we think that women should remain home raising kids. I'm not that kind of person. We don't have kids, but I always thought that raising a family is not one side job. It's two sides. I mean, it's like a road. It has two ways. So in order for someone to be successful, you have to sometimes, you know, let things go that you like to do so that person can achieve their success. Maybe you become a successful performer and become famous and money will come. And the sacrifice brought some positive income or outcomes to it. So, I mean, that's the way I look at things. So I read that, you know, sometimes, your partner were not that supportive on that part. And that's a shame, because, and that's one of the things about musicians, doesn't matter the gender, sometimes, you know, you have to be away for a week, for 2 weeks, or touring, like, you know, for a whole year, because that's part of your job. That's part of the things that you have to do in order to still remain trendy in the music business, because that's the other thing. Exactly. It's hard. And in classical music, it's hard to be, you know, trendy and to be relevant. That's one of the things that I realized, that classical music is hard to get in. And once you get inside that world, it's not easy to remain there if you don't do touring and performances and, you know, knock some doors and ask for, you know, let me in and start playing. How hard was for you to become, you know, well known in the field of music, in tuba specifically?
Well, it's interesting, because if you're attached to an ensemble, that's one way sometimes people do that. So I became known when I won the position with the Coast Guard Band in New London. And then I was able to attend the festivals and the conventions, and everyone knew who I was. And then I made the decision that I wanted to leave that and do something else. I did 7 years active duty Coast Guard. It was a wonderful organization, but because I had only been 20 when I started, I felt like I hadn't done anything else and I wanted to see more of the world and have more freedom. The military is very restrictive. So I left the Coast Guard and I kind of started over where maybe nobody knew me again. So if I had stayed in, I would have had that name. Oh, she's Principal Tuba in the Coast Guard Band. Oh, okay. So then I think that one of the ways that I've done that is I've recognized that some of the most important things we do are not the ones that pay the highest. This is a long conversation for a different day, but I think that some of the most important musical experiences I have had have been at going to conferences where I wasn't paid to perform. but like the International Tuba, you know, conference or convention or a festival where you go and the whole reason you're there is to network and to perform and listen to everyone else and maybe sit on a panel discussion. And I did that every single year. And I paid my own way. Again, I'm paying a babysitter so that I could go and do that. And I'm going and I'm practicing and I'm presenting recitals. And I also spent money on things like marketing, things like nice photos and a website. And I invested money in that. And I also didn't get discouraged because what I wanted to do wasn't really what anybody else wanted to do. The types of things I want to play aren't the norm and weren't at the time. And I think I just stayed strong. And I also was willing to embrace and look foolish, like when social media first came out.
Well, you know, you have to make it in a way that is appealing to the people. And if you show joy, I mean, funny, if you don't do it that way, well, then you don't track clicks to your website or TikTok or whatever. You need to do that in order to have some audience, to pull some audience to you.
Yes, and it's a tricky line, isn't
it? And that's hard to do.
Yeah, you don't want to seem like you're selling something to them because none of us want to see that. We just are genuinely interested in learning about the person. So this is a tricky thing. And I feel like part of it too is because I moved here to take the job at UNC Pembroke. This is my 15th year teaching here, and I love it. And it is down in rural North Carolina. It's a low population area. There's lots of cornfields and cows. And on my way to work, I pass the chicken truck with the chickens going.
It's much better than being in South Carolina.
So South Carolina is just a stone's throw away. And when I was here, I wasn't connected to my peers back in New England when I left Connecticut. And so I really felt like I needed people to see, I'm still here. Here I am. I'm still here. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to still travel. And going to conferences and festivals is something that I map out years ahead. I have a folder next to me where I printed a year at a glance for 2023, all the months on one big sheet of paper. And I'm already marking the festivals that I'm going to try to go to so that I spread them out and make it manageable. But I'm already thinking, because we're starting to see things come back, that I'm planning 2023. I just added one today. So I'm thinking ahead to that travel. That's where I'm going and meeting people, trying to play well, trying to present that. And that's what worked for me.
Do you start as a professor at the university, you started as a dean of the music
started faculty. as a professor. The advertisement was for a teacher of trombone, euphonium, and tuba. And the percussion teacher had done his doctorate with me at the Hart School. So he called me and he said, "Hey, we have this job. It's full-time and it's a tenure track line.
That's for you."
Yes. So he said, "You should dust off your trombone playing though, because I do play trombone, but it's my third instrument after tuba, euphonium." And so I practiced trombone every night. And I came and I won the position and I taught trombone, euphonium, and tuba, as well as music history. This is a small department of music. And that's what I did all the way up until this past January. So it's only been in the last 6 months that I have become part of the dean's office, right? So it's an associate dean position. Thank you. It's great because I can teach if I want, but I'm seeing it's a student success position. So I'm overseeing things like the classes and any concerns and schedules for
how about curriculum?
More than 3,000 students. Yes, the curriculum and things like how many math classes do we have and how many math classes should we have and do we have enough of this and does this work properly for the student to graduate in 4 years? And if there's a problem, how can we help and smooth the path for the students? There's more than 3,000 students that I oversee as part of the arts and sciences. So it's much larger than the music department.
It is interesting. I think colleges and universities is like hospitals. They work on deficit. They work on red numbers. And sometimes when you have this high-ranking position within the academia, it has some challenges. What are those challenges that you're seeing right now that you want to succeed in accomplishing?
One of the challenges is, because of COVID, the amount of rigor, the strength of our instruction switching to online. I think in many of the secondary schools or high schools, some students lost some. They lost some level in things like math, especially. And so one of our challenges is we're getting students coming in from the local high schools who had 2 years of COVID, sort of like kind of missing. Mm-hmm. The test scores are showing that their math is lower than it was before, and reading, of course, too. And so one of our challenges now is, all right, what can we do to make sure that these students who are worse off in some of these academic areas than the students used to be, but all the classes are the same, how do we make those students still be okay for the four-year degree? That's one big challenge that we're seeing. And another is that sometimes the students and their families might not see the value of college in the same way today as they did a generation or two ago. There's a sense now that maybe college isn't needed. This is a long-term challenge for all of us, I think, in the field of education. How do you say to a business person in the, you know, House of Representatives and in your state capital, who is probably a corporate person, mm-hmm. how do you tell them that this is valuable and how do you show that? And so that's an interesting conversation too. And so we're working on making sure that the students can get through while there's much more challenges, economic challenges, challenges due to things like the situation in our country, like we talked about when we first came on our call today, this sense of who and what are valued by our nation. And so some students are getting left behind in the economy, and bringing them up and making sure that they have the same opportunity. That's another thing I wanted to do.
Yeah, one of the things that people are looking more is, so how I make money much faster.
Yeah, it's quicker. Everything needs to be quick.
And the thing is that I was reading the other day that many people has quit school because they want to be famous, and they started their own YouTube channel doing DIY and other things. And I was like, okay, we're just cutting education just to make money because we're thinking that money is everything. But I always say that a country without culture, a country without music, it's like a dead road. You're gonna crash and you're gonna lose a lot of good things, and you will become unknown and people will not visit. One of the things I always like about going to Europe is the amount of musicians on the street performing.
Yes.
Because I feel that their culture is alive, that the city is alive. Here, you see that almost mostly on the big cities. Are you going to see more events and supporting students playing out of the, you know, out of the schoolroom, outside on the campus, so they can, you know, improve their music skills? Are you going to support that and push students to do that?
Absolutely, because it's one of our core things that we do to try to give them that experience so that they can go out and work. So things like lighting up our main building, Old Main, it's called, and it has pillars. You can imagine a southern looking building. Mm-hmm. We have a ceremony where the chancellor turns on the lights every holiday season, and there's almost always some kind of instrumental group. The flute choir played it one time, sometimes the singing choir, the opportunities for our students to go out and play for the rest of campus. And that's been a little bit quieted down from COVID. But now we're really ramping that back up again and taking them out on the road. We take them on a little bus and take them to a jazz festival in South Carolina. We just took a group of students there last semester, let them play in front of other people outside the college. Yes, the marching band is big here. We march in parades. And in fact, they came up to DC right before COVID and played a Festival of Lights parade. So there's a lot of focus on getting students experiences like this travel, even if it's just a weekend to go play a parade, or the marching band traveling with the football team to Florida or somewhere else within our conference. So one of the things that we do in the dean's office is try to put funding toward those student travel, so as much as possible, and giving them things like internships or world travel, global travel. We hope will open back up now as COVID hopefully continues to decline. The trips, either study abroad for a whole semester or things like just going for a week, like a spring break week, sending the students to somewhere where they can play for a week just on spring break. Those are all things that some of us might have done back in the day for college that really gave us a leg up. that we want to put back.
How about reaching out to the community, like playing to the community, having the community get involved with the campus? Because sometimes everything is within, you know, like has a big wall around the campus.
Yes.
And it's hard to get inside. But sometimes reaching out to the community and having the community involved with everything going around within the campus, in theater, music, or conferences, bringing people from those community nearby, that might also help achieve your goals.
Absolutely. And they can support, right? We have a day each September. We call it Pembroke Day. And all of the community is invited. They serve a free lunch. So you come onto campus and you get to have a free lunch. But more importantly, everyone sets up booths and crafts and, you know, apparel and jewelry and all of the wonderful different things people can sell. But then also all of the areas and departments have their booths, and the choir sings. There's Native American drumming and singing, and the veteran students post the colors. There's every variety of campus event. The marching band plays. And so that's an example of when we're inviting the community right onto the lawn in front of our building and eating and drinking together and experiencing fellowship. It's such an important anyway, but especially because after COVID, people have felt less connected.
Yep.
That's a real, we're experiencing it everywhere, but especially on a college campus, the students are a little more socially awkward, the young ones, right? And so, you know, they'd rather just sit in the dorm and take their class via their laptop and turn off their camera. And that is their ideal. So
that's the worst.
We'd like to bring them back out of it again and remind them that interaction is awesome. So it's a struggle to reset that after
2 years.
But we're doing it. Yes, we're doing it.
It is hard.
Students, they really are. They crave it. They just sometimes don't know that.
COVID has done so much damage. And I know that we have to take precautions, and sometimes we have to, you know, to commit to taking care of ourselves, but we have lost track of being connected to other people. And we have seen too much aggression, too much violence after the COVID. I was going to ask you a question about I remember the question. So having been a student in master and PhD degrees programs, what are those experiences that you're bringing or you're breaking out from as a dean of a music faculty department? What kind of new things you're bringing to the board that you don't want to replicate because you realize those are not the best way to teach students or to address the way the education should be given to the students?
That's a really good question. And sort of the flip side of, you know, how do you make college great is what do we get rid of? What can we set aside, right? And one of those things is that it used to be that there was a thought that college wasn't for everybody. And in fact, most people would have said college probably wasn't for most everybody, and only a select few got to go, right? That was sort of the old model back in my mom's day, that only the elite, 20% perhaps, maybe my grandmother would have said, right? Only those 20% go on to college and everybody else is a laborer, mm-hmm, and does something
blue collar,
else, right?
Yeah, blue collar.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so now there's a different idea. Now the idea is most everybody is college material and should have that opportunity to do that or some other type of training. And there's a lot of care to make sure that we equate other types of training as equal in value to society. That's another new thing. We're trying to get rid of the hierarchy where college is at the top and something like electricians, trading is not. That's equal. And so we're really trying to re-vocabularize it. And so one of the things that is true in this is that the students that aren't automatic fits for college, that might have struggled a little more, they never really got their study habits, they need a little more help. And in the situation before, they would have just dropped out because they would have felt ill at ease and they wouldn't have been ready. Now we're really trying to reach back and help carry them along. So there's more things in place than when I went to school. We use this term student success, which is part of my title. what that really means is keeping them in school until they get the degree and getting them through on time and happy and mentally stable and all of these things, confident young people. And they could be somebody who's come back to school, or they could be military. And so now there's an understanding that you can't just put the information out there, and if they don't get it, too bad. You need to help them, and why aren't they getting it? And so there's a lot of more one-on-one, an understanding that you'll come to meet the student where they are, instead of just putting the information on the website, and if they don't do it, thinking that that's okay. There's no winnowing out. And I think that's interesting, because I think the professors that of my generation, when I was in school, they would have said, well, if she doesn't want to do it, there'll be somebody else auditioning next year. And that attitude of it's only here for the elite few who can tough it out and understand how to go through all the hoops.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And if you don't know hoops, if you grew up in a household where people didn't go through very many hoops, or you didn't have a very good organizational life ahead of you.
Or you don't have the skills.
Right. You can learn them here. And I think that's a wonderful change, because it's going to make it much more diverse.
One of the things that I have noticed on many music departments is that they're more focused on teaching music. But I mean, it's not only music department, it's mostly in all the fields, is how to face the economic world out there. For example, the business structure. When I was in law school, I remember that we learned everything, you know, everything, the cases, the statutes, the procedures, everything. But we never learned the business part of becoming a lawyer. So we graduated, we passed the bar, and we started applying jobs for different law firms or government entities. But for those who wanted to establish their own practice, we didn't have the skills or the tools to know what to do.
Right.
The same happens in the music field. I mean, they've graduated, they know how to perform and to read music sheets and everything, but when they go to find a gig in a venue, sometimes patrons or the owner of the venues get advantage, because we just not ripe.
That's right.
And they take advantage of our, it's not ignorance, but a lack of experience in how to negotiate the terms of a contract on a record label, or how much money I will get from performing in a bar.
Right.
Are your school trying to teach students about how to face that economic world, that market out there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And we're working with an outdated model, as you say, because these music schools here in the U.S. were all founded in the late 1800s, and they were all founded so that we could train our own American musicians, because up until then, the Europeans had been coming over and playing in the American orchestras.
We were following the European tradition of Orthodox classes.
Yeah, so let's have our own music schools, and we founded them all over, and they had boys and girls in them, as I mentioned in my dissertation, but really they were training you to play in a large ensemble, a symphony or a concert band, and you wouldn't really have needed a ton of business skills for that, because you just accepted the contract and then that was it. So there wasn't a sense that you needed to be all those things you said. You weren't going to negotiate with the concert hall. The symphony was going to do that. You weren't going to negotiate with the hotel. The symphony was going to do that. And so there was this sense that you just needed to be able to kill the rest of the competition at the audition. And that was sort of the extent of the music school's responsibility for you. Yeah. And now we're really seeing that those symphony jobs have gone away. They've dried up. A lot of the symphonies that were around in 1950 are not still here today. And so the music world has shifted, of course. And so for our students, we have now what is common, which is a music business degree, though you can still take those classes in any, we have also music education. So if you wanted to be a music educator, but why not take something in website design, for example, graphics. So we have a business school here at UNC Pembroke, and through our School of Business, in collaboration with the music department, we have a music degree with emphasis in business, and they take those classes like the marketing, the accounting, and even in, I'm going to just side note that even in conferences like our International Women's Brass Conference, I'm remembering that there was a seminar on taxes at that very first one in 1993. And I remember it being interesting because nobody had ever said anything to me about taxes.
Especially Social Security.
Musician taxes are incredibly complicated, but so this sense that we just were expected to know, and that's that elitism again. So yes, so our school has a music business degree. I think most of the students there would tell us that they want to make rap albums. That would be hip hop albums. That would be what they would tell you is their goal. They may be going to Nashville or Memphis, which are two cities not too far from here, that they would work in the recording industry. And so they're getting very hands-on. They're recording for their classes, they're learning to mix and master, and they're fine-tuning their ears. And so, yeah, so this is a popular new thing. And people like me sometimes go around and speak at these music business panels to talk about this marketing things. And we still have some of those myths that we need to get rid of. But we're on our way. And I think the young people really understand that their business is in their hands in a way that I never did when I was 20. It's a very interesting shift.
Well, folks, I hope that you like this first part of the episode. As you noticed, we just finished with the part of her as being part of a member of the University of North Carolina Pembroke Music Department. I wanted to make an emphasis on her dissertation, and because I got it right here, is on the Brass Quarterly, the periodical Brass Quarterly, where the person that writes there, she addresses everyone, is Marie Ramusen. She's still, what she wrote the reviews on the Brass Quarterly, she still retains the use of masculine language in discussion, even in editorials written by Ramusen herself. So that was very interesting, seeing how we men, because we are to be blamed, decided to shape the world and the language through gender. And that's wrong. And we need to fix that. But we don't only need to fix that. We also have to act on it. Because fixing it by using other words is not enough. We have to be proactive. We have to be active. And I also want to share with you what I say in the beginning of the intro about this amazing person who decided to, in a way, it was Robert West. An article written by Robert Wiss. I'm going to read from Joanna's dissertation. One article from 1970 discusses Faye Hanson, a brass player and teacher at Weber State College. The article by Robert Wiss, contains a review of a recent trumpet symposium in which Hanson gave a masterclass on trumpet performance and pedagogy. Wiss spotlights several performers and in the section on Hanson writes a positive review of her work. There we are good. We are fine with that positive review of her work, highlighting some of her recommended teaching techniques and philosophies. He concludes the section with the statement, "Probably the finest compliment I could pay to Miss Hanson will be that I have every confidence in her abilities, and moreover, I will be delighted to have her teach my own children." For whatever reason, Wiss felt he needed to conclude his review of Hanson's work with his personal statement. Why will he feel it necessary to mention that he had confidence in her abilities? He did not mention that he had confidence in the abilities of the other performers discussed in the review. Wiss likely viewed the emergence of a female trumpet player and teacher as a new development worthy of comment. Whatever the intent, the addition of this statement to an otherwise positive article can be viewed as an indication of the rarity of women in the brass world at this time. Just let me paraphrase what you want to say there. There is no reason to talk about the abilities of a woman as a performer, it would not do the same for her male counterpart. either you're a good performer or you're a bad performer. But we don't highlight the abilities of a female versus not highlighting the abilities of a male counterpart. If you listen to the first one and the second one is from the Ocuan Mirabilis record from Joanna. The first one is a 12-piece Vite et Nervus Man rythme from Nadia Boulanger that she was born in 1886 and 1979. It's a 3-piece movement. That was the third one. The last one you're going to listen to is Elegy for a King, written by Portia Nyoku. I hope that you like this episode. If you like it, please share it. Click to the like button. If you listen to iTunes, click the 5 stars, leave a comment. If you listen to Spotify, also click the like button. And just wait for the next part. It's going to be uploaded next Wednesday. I promise you it's going to be Wednesday. Thank you for listening to this episode. And I'll leave you with Elegy for a King. Have a great week. I mean, besides so many publications, I mean, it is hard. I mean, one of the things that was going through your, I mean, your on your website and your interviews is that it is hard to cover all the topics.
Right. There are a lot of areas. And I think part of that might be like what we're going to talk about today, this sense of needing to make sure I need to do it all, or there's a sense that I don't want to leave a stone unturned, because what if that was going to be needed later?
Yeah. I mean, and besides, there is so much, I don't know why I cannot listen to myself. Now I can listen to myself. I was really low. I was sounding like in a volume 4. That's why I have a technology. I mean, that's why I'm doing everything by myself. I need a producer.
Because I'm realizing that you might, I don't know if you're going to get a little echo. So I can throw the headphones on too, and
sure,
we'll see. That might be better.
One of the things, I haven't finished your dissertation. There is 54 pages left.
But I think you got the gist, right? You got all the historical stuff. That was the main point.
My question is, how many people that have been interview you has read your...
I think you're probably the only one.
Well, besides the other person who just asked about your dissertation that just...
Right.
And she's from Germany, and she's a tuba player.
Yes, and so she knows me because when I go each year, of course, COVID stopped it, but... We have a relationship because she went to a low brass or a brass workshop that I teach at in Germany. And she came and we befriended each other. And yes, and she used to live in the U.S. So she's super wonderful and got great English. And so
that's one of the things that I always struggle with many people that works in academia is that their thesis remains within that field, never goes out.
Yep, that was a really good point you made when you posted it. Like, let's talk about these. And I did publish a little of it.
And that
would have been just in the same, a little journal that 12 people read.
And the thing is that this dissertation is more relevant today than a year ago because all the things happening now.
Oh my gosh.